Okay, Howard.
Just a point of detail, Adam. You mentioned the sort of pretty well established fact that it was about 10,000 years ago that private property seriously came into being with the advent of settled agriculture, etc. You said that 30 or 40,000 years was well, 20, it would be 20 or 30,000 years before that that saw the beginning of modern humans. Now, I think that's changed, hasn't it? The ideas on this have changed. I mean, when I was first in the party many years ago, that was what sort of people thought, that modern humans were about 40,000 years old, so to speak. But the sort of research and findings and archaeology that's been done since then, I think has sort of changed that. And, you know, most things you read nowadays about the existence of modern humans suggest they've been around for a couple of hundred thousand years. They didn't move much for a long time. They were in Africa for, and they only really started to move from Africa maybe 30, 40, 50,000 years ago. But nevertheless, modern, you know, anatomically and cerebrally modern humans seem to have been around sort of far longer. And that sort of strengthens our case in a way, because it's not just for 20 or 30,000 years of the existence of humans that we had some form of common ownership, but maybe 150, 160,000 years. So I'm not sure what you think about these timescales, Adam. You said 30 or 40,000. Would you sort of stick to that or not?
Well, I'm not an anthropologist, either a physical or a cultural anthropologist. If this is under discussion, it comes along, you know, fair enough. I'm not insisting on the time, but of course, what early humans, I think, in fact, early pre-humans, for that matter, were living like other animals, weren't they? Basically, we were just taking from nature what they needed to survive, and the difference would have been that they had some sort of consciousness. So they could plan, and also that they had access, they made tools and instruments to extract from nature what they need. But basically, the early humans and pre-humans would have been, as I say, in the same position as other animals, just taking from nature what they needed to live. But maybe there's somebody else here that's read more modern stuff about this than you're suggesting I have. And I'm basically based on what Leakey and people like that said. I mean, maybe they've been surpassed.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a lot of stuff on this in recent years, and I mean, every time you read something, it seems to get pushed further and further back, to be honest. At one point, it was considered to be 100 and then 150, but now it seems to be saying sort of quite widely that you're looking at least 200,000. But okay, and who knows whether, you know, whether that won't change as well. But as you say, you know, Richard Leakey and Co. in their day thought it was 30 or 40,000, but you know, as I say, I think it's been pushed significantly further back.
Yeah, but if I'm honest, this talk is based on a talk I gave in the 1990s. Right. But Brian, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. Can you hear me all right? Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, great. A couple of things. The first thing is that you failed to mention the positive things that capitalism have done in regards to social evolution, because that's what he was talking about, the social evolution of class society. To me, the most positive thing that capitalism has done is illustrated to us how we have got the capabilities of producing the potential for an abundance. It's there all around us, this potential. We see it everywhere we look. You know, overproduction, especially overproduction and waste of products. ample food, ample clothes, ample transport, ample housing, loads and loads, you know. All right, it's not getting there because distribution depends, like you said, on profits, right? But the potential is there. It's just that we've got to be able to take political power and turn that around. And that brings me to my second point, that being that the next revolution, which we expect to be the socialist revolution, is going to be different from our previous revolutions. Previous revolutions had the economic model to go on. They first of all achieved the economics and then they took political power. This was seen with the capitalist class, right? They introduced capitalism here, there and everywhere. You know, you had the banking system, the accumulation of capital and all the rest of it, the Industrial Revolution, everything was going there. But it was only later that they came about and achieved political power. The socialist revolution is going to be the opposite of that. We're not going for the economic revolution first, which is, you know, quite frankly, is impossible to achieve. You can't have an economic system of capitalism within, economic system of socialism within capitalism. Right, so that leaves us no choice in that we've got to, first of all, take on political power. We've got to capture that political power, right, and ensure that the armed might of the capitalist class is neutralized. And then once we've done that, then we introduce economics. But let's not forget that we will, way before, even before we take political power, we will be planning and preparing for this economic move to take place, you know, but once we take political power. So everything will be in hand, right? You know, we'll know just about exactly how many people we need to make a ton of steel, et cetera, you know, what transportation methods we need to deliver human needs, right, which is very important, you know, and how are we going to implement all the other production methods that's going to take place, you know. But so we need to keep in mind, you know, that unlike previous revolutions, right, it's going to be the political revolution first, right, and then the economic revolution after that. And above all else, right, it is going to be a revolution unlike previous revolutions, again, without any leaders, right? The working class themselves are going to constitute the leadership. In other words, every member of the working class will be a leader, but with a small L, not with a large L. They won't, you know, they won't be the Bolsheviks or anything like that. They will be there putting in their ideas on this, that, and that, whatever subject, you know, and making sure that the revolution and the revolutions themselves, you know, pick up the pace, etc. I think that's all I've got to say on that. I don't know what you feel on it. You know, just to finish off, Adam, sorry. The main thing is as far as we are concerned as socialists, is the pace of class consciousness is not keeping pace with the changes that are taking place within class society, right? The only little bit of class consciousness, if we could say that, that I see around anyway, is that that's taking place, is that the ideas of racism and sexism are now on the back foot. And that is taking place. But what is not taking place is that the working class themselves started to think for themselves. That certainly is not on the agenda at the present moment, as I can see it. Okay, sorry, Adam, but there you go.
Yeah, well, it's the traditional Marxist position which the party's had, and I think it's correct, is that capitalism was a necessary phase of social evolution. And what capitalism did was, as you say, provide the material basis for a world socialist society. But not all people have agreed with that position. There are people who have said that, for instance, the diggers could have established a communistic society of the sorts at that time. And various anarchists have the same position, that the communist society could have been established at any time in history. I mean, at the present time, that's a bit of an academic argument, because that's talking about the past. Everybody can agree now that the conditions are there for establishing a worldwide socialist society, and then they have been created by capitalists. It doesn't matter whether they were possible or not in the past. But I think a consequence of this is, in fact, that the economic revolution or the technological revolution has already taken place. Capitalism has already created, has already socialized production. It already is social in a sense. Well, in a sense, it really is. And all that's needed now is to bring ownership and control into line with technology and economics. I wouldn't quite put it the way you put it. We'll get political power, and then the economic revolution, the economic evolution, has already taken place. We need working class need to capture political power, win control of political power, in order to abolish private property, which has become outdated. So that would be my take on that. Andy, you're next, I think.
Thank you. Brian, I totally agree with everything you said. And I love the analogy that you used, actually, when you said, you know, we need to know. I'm sorry if I'm paraphrasing you wrongly or making it too simple, but you said something like, we need to know in advance of the revolution how many people it would take to make a ton of steel, you know, and that makes a really good point to me. That's beautiful. I just think that's really a great way to sort of put your point across. Without wanting to sort of diminish anything that we sort of put across in our public synthesis of our politics. And Adam, thank you again, actually, for your talk. That was really excellent. I think we've got the problem for us is, I think we know that the economic situation is just there. It's an open, stable door, really, isn't it? You know, that we live in a world of abundance, absolute abundance. And I think I'm probably one of those people in the party that argues, you know, that... we shouldn't expect people in a socialist society, especially poor people, to have less, you know, after a transformation in society. The problem we have, and I don't know the answer to this, I can't fathom it out at all. And I struggle with the philosophy side of you know, socialism's higher level thinkers like Marx and others. But basically, we can't achieve this until there is a mass class consciousness. That is a prerequisite for any of the ideas that we can talk about here and have talked about, you know, as you know, the organization has talked about for 100 years. Until there is that consciousness to receive these ideas and to act collectively upon them, it will always be a small group of some quite learned people, not myself. I don't include myself in that. But, very sort of well educated, quite critically kind of grounded people. I won't mention any names, but there's a few of you around this meeting tonight. And who can do that? But, let's be quite frank about it. Your average Josephine or Joe just doesn't do that. And that's why our ideas aren't connecting. And at the meeting, Central Branch had a meeting, or Central Online Branch had a meeting. And I know Janet is certainly here tonight as well. And we talked about this, and Janet was explaining to me that, I don't know how many years ago, you would have members on the balcony at the head office hectoring each other, about the slow progress of slow progress in making socialists for the party. Ron Cook used to say to me, if anybody remembers Ron, I mean, he was a mentor for me really when I first joined the party. We have to make socialists. If you meet someone, turn them into a socialist. And I thought, well, crikey, I've got to do that 6 billion times. How possible is that? But actually, in the sort of world we live in now, where we have mass communication, there's been an explosion of mass communication now over the past 25 years or whatever it is. And obviously it's gone on since the probably early 20th century. We don't seem to have done very well at it. So I'm not saying that it's our fault. What I'm trying to sort of suggest is that our job is to just keep these ideas alive, because one day everybody else will cotton on and catch up. I don't think you can force the issue. Even though, as Brian was saying, everything's there, the bed is made, the whole thing is ready. It isn't an economic sort of material revolution that needs to happen. It's a mindset revolution and a political revolution in the minds of the vast majority of people on the earth. So anyway, thank you. I probably rambled a bit there, but I'm just trying to say what I think. Thank you.
I interpret you as saying that socialism is oven ready. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, oven ready. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Has anybody else got anything to say on anything, basically? But the other thing which I was trying to make is the idea of property and common property and collective property. I think we can put across our case better if we talk about no property. In other words, you can see why people think that state ownership might have something to do with socialism. But state ownership is still ownership by still ownership. I mean, the state has rights as against the rest of the population. But what we're really arguing for is no ownership. The idea of access and use instead. That was a point I was going to make towards the end. But anyway, as I say, people can talk about that or anything else they want to talk about. I know we say, following William Morris, that our task is to make socialists, but in fact, capitalism is what makes socialists. In one sense, capitalism creates problems for people, and people look around and discuss and try to find out what causes these problems and what is the solution. So, I mean, if you like, the emergence of socialist consciousness is a combination of capitalist conditions and people hearing from people who are socialists already, explaining what it's all about. So it's a two-way process. It's not just a question of us making socialists in the sense of converting people one by one. I mean, that's a bit of a caricature of what our position is. But in effect, what we are doing is making socialists in the sense that we're putting up a point of view for people to hear. Right, Andy.
I suppose where I was coming from on that, Adam, if I've understood you correctly, is that, you know, obviously I was very influenced by Karl Marx and so on in my younger years. Marx could only have made the impact that he did and reached the understandings that he did because of the point in history that he was, and not just the point in history, but the geographical location that he was in at the time as well. And it was because it was, he thought there was a, you know, inexorable movement towards changing this capitalist system. You know, and he got a few bits of that, sort of his predictions didn't turn out the way that he'd hoped. But at least there was at that time an actual sort of growing, well, they called it the Communist Party, didn't they? It wasn't an actual formal political party. It was just called the Communist Party, and it was something that he hoped would spread throughout Europe, you know. So, but it was happening, you know, at the time there was this kind of mass consciousness developing. And I suppose that's really what I think is really lacking now. Social democracy seems to be about as good as it gets, really, for anybody that's critical of capitalism generally, apart from a few outliers like ourselves.
I'm not sure that Marx in his day did think that the conditions were ripe for the immediate establishment of a communist system of society. So he ends up in a sort of position taking sides in wars and so on what he thinks will expedite the development of industry. And so he was right. He was active in an era quite different from ours. He was active in an era when capitalism still had some further development to go. Not much, because I mean, shortly after Marx died, Engels was saying, "Look, we're here. Abundance is possible." But I mean, in 1848, they might have thought that socialism or communism was possible then. But when you look at the immediate measures in the Communist Manifesto, they're there to develop further the means of production. And unfortunately, that part of Marx was taken up by people like Lenin and turned to justify state capitalism as a stage between, you know, before you could get to proper socialism. But we're not committed to everything Marx did, and maybe not even committed to everything Marx said. But I think he got it right that the trend, as he saw it, was towards the development of the world market economy, which would eventually provide the basis for a world socialist society. You know? Yeah, Brian.
Yes, Sam, yeah. I just want to add, you know, I've spotted what Andrew was saying on making socialists. Really need to be careful here, right? Because what it's implying there, that term, making socialists, is that we're talking at the working class. And not talking with the working class. In other words, we're looking at a process of converting. And that in itself implies that we're on a religious quest, on a mission. Right? The actual fact of the matter is that self-emancipation calls, right, for a totally different mindset to the present mindset that the working class are holding. And it will call for self-conversion. In other words, they've got to take themselves out of the present position and put themselves in the real position of class consciousness and what is in the best interests of that class. The The other thing is, once they've attained that, right, they can then go on to not just challenge the capitalist system by political action, but also condemn it, condemn the capitalist system for all the harm that it's doing to the planet and to the species that's abound here on the planet. It is, you know, presently, and very recently, just a day or so ago, it was announced that the climate change, the warning that was given out years ago of a 2%, I think, was the change in the climate temperature, that has now dropped as certainly that within the next 5 years, there's going to be a change, a possible change of 1.5%, which would bring us on course for the effects of climate change being felt not in 30 years, right, but possibly within 20 years. So I won't be around to see it. Oh, that's a dead shirt, right? But it will be possible with members of the Socialist Party will be around to see it and hopefully put out the case even more succinctly in the need for a socialist revolution. And on that point, I differ with you a little bit on the suggestion that the conditions for the economic revolution have already been achieved, in that capitalism has brought about social production, you know, and an integrated and also an integrated global production unit, single production unit on a global scale. Right. In that, this might well be the fact, right? But what we've got to do through the achievement of political power is bring in production for use and free access for the whole of the human population. And that will be in itself will be an economic revolution, right, on a far greater scale than what has already been achieved, you know, under capitalism, most definitely, right? You know, because it will open up the common store of the natural resources of the earth, right, to the whole of the species within the earth. And that's not just human beings, but also all the other animals that exist here. I think that's about it.
No, I don't think we are people from outside the working class preaching to the working class. What we are members of the working class who are trying to convince fellow members. I mean, the Declaration of Principles is a sort of distillation of the experience of the working class up until that point, that there is a class struggle and so on, and what society's based on. So we're just conveying to other members of the working class the experience of, you know, of the working class in the past. But I agree that using words like convert and making socialists can give the impression that we're just like, you know, religious groups trying to convert people. Well, that's not what we're doing. I think Andy said it actually. What we're doing is we're keeping alive, I suppose, when we're putting it. We're putting over the, you know, the idea of socialism, you know, based on past experience of the workers. So it's there, and you know, that's our job. I mean, nobody else is doing just this. All other groups that call themselves socialists are advocating reforms or national independence or you know, something like that. We're the only people who are actually putting the, you know, the straight case for socialism, and you know, so nobody else is doing this. Let's And nobody else wanted to say anything, or was this going to be a brains trust between Brian, Andy and me?
I'm prepared to let Jared go first.
Okay, Jared, if you switch yourself on or off. Or...
I don't know where you can see me, because I can't see me on my screen. So I don't know where I've disappeared to, but never mind, as long as you can see me. You can, good, good. I'm probably going to oversay what other people have said, because I haven't been able to hear. Some people haven't got very good clear voices for transmission. I had to blame it on other people, because that's a thing that old people do, isn't it? Blame it on everybody else. First of all, I was going to say that it wasn't me, Andrew, that was at the central online meeting on Sunday that said about the people shouting from the balcony floor. It was Pat. That is not my memory. I wasn't there at that time. Unfortunately, because of our age and probably our looks a little bit, we tend to get mistaken for each other. But it wasn't me. She had the experience of that people shouting from the balcony. She also had the experience, which I did actually talk about, was when she was at one conference and somebody stood up and was shouting like at her and going red in the face while he was doing it, which wasn't a very pleasant experience. But what I was going to say was that, and I've said it many times before, probably not very well, but I think there are all sorts of strands within society, not necessarily only in this country, well, hopefully not just in this country, who are thinking along lines of common ownership and thinking things could be better than this. There could be a better way of organising. It can't be good that there is an immensely wealthy level in society that owns everything, as far as even ordinary people can see, ordinary people like members of the poor people of the working class like me can see. It's ridiculous that we now have, what is it, 1, 2, or 3 multi-millionaire, multi-billionaire men who are going on a lovely, for them, ego trip of sending rockets to the moon for people to walk on the moon, and their names are going to be written on the rockets as well. There must be an awful lot of people who are thinking, but I'm having trouble paying my bills. I can't heat my house. I can't buy enough food. There must be a lot of people that are thinking, what are those men thinking of doing? You know, these poorer people might well say, okay, they're very rich and let them do that, but let them look after those around them who are not very well off first before they go on these ego trips. I think there must be a lot of people that are thinking like that. And also, when I came into the party, I didn't have any political background. I didn't have anybody to talk to about politics. And it was a pure luck that I was in Trafalgar Square and bought a Socialist Standard from someone in the 60s. And I then went on to get pamphlets and stuff from, and eventually the Socialist Standard delivered to me. So I was doing an awful lot of reading. The circumstances of my life enabled me to do that reading. I didn't have children, and it was a fairly quiet time. I could spend time reading, unlike a lot of women of my same age as me who would have been busy looking after young children and probably doing a job, doing some sort of work as well. I think that I was lucky in my political attainment. Now, if I hadn't bought that standard in the Trafalgar Square, what would I have been? I would have been a person that was searching in the wilderness for some answer to the thoughts that I was having. And they wouldn't have been there. I might well have become some sort of reformist, but it wouldn't have been quite a dissatisfied reformist, because there wasn't an answer for my questions that I had at that time. So I can only be glad that I think his name was Pete Doherty, so was selling standards in Trafalgar Square. And there we are. And by the way, Pat sent her apologies. She isn't able to be here tonight because she's got family visiting. Otherwise, she's sorry to have missed the meeting. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I think it would have been Jimmy Doherty, wouldn't it?
Was it? Right, oh, yeah.
What a Jimmy Doherty used to say. Anyway, those were the good old days when we had this political discussions at conference, not just technical things.
Yes.
Perhaps they weren't all that good. Anyway, Moggy, you want to say something?
Well, yes, it's just an observation. I was having this same conversation with a friend the other night, talking about private property and how we wouldn't have that sort of thing under socialism. And she said, well, what's to stop someone coming up to you and saying, well, I want your house now. You've lived in it long enough. It's my turn. So I'm not sure how, I wasn't quite sure how to answer that. I said, well, I think people will still be able to have a place they can call home without having to move out of it and make room for somebody else. So have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I can put it this way. I think we'll all be living in council houses in socialism. Because, well, no, seriously, I mean, I don't mean sink estate council houses, but I mean the houses will belong to the community and will be put at the disposal of people to use. I know that Bernard Shaw sort of asked in socialism, who's going to live on Richmond Hill? Who's going to live in the best parts of the country? But I don't imagine there'll be private ownership of houses in a socialist society. They'll belong to the community and be allocated to people, according to their need. But I'm sure people will have security of tenure in a socialist society. You won't be able to be kicked out of your house. So I mean, that would be my answer to that particular question. But anyway, I see Howard wants to give his answer.
I was going to talk about something else, but I will give a response to that anyway. My response to that, I mean, you get those questions, don't you? I mean, what if I want something that you've got and it's not immediately available to me? What's to stop me taking it? Well, what's to stop you taking it is that a socialist society, like any other society, human society, has to have rules. There have to be rules which compel, if you like, reasonable behaviour. It would manifestly be unreasonable for somebody to try and forcibly or otherwise sort of take over the place you're living because they fancy it one day, and they wouldn't be allowed to do it. The culture of that society would be such they wouldn't be allowed to do it. If they nevertheless tried to do it despite that, there'd have to be rules which would prevent them, just in the same way as there'd have to be rules to prevent somebody from harming somebody else physically just because they felt like or they didn't like them. So, I think there are obvious answers to these and to questions like that. And, you know, the answers are that, all societies need rules of one kind or the other that the members of that society agree to abide by. There wouldn't be the sort of massive, problems that capitalism produces, that capitalism has got its rules, but we know what its rules are for, and people often sort of try to break the rules either because they need to or because their mentality is such that they they've been driven to it. Now, the other thing I wanted to say was that I think what Janet implied was absolutely right. We are not alone. We are not alone. There are lots of other people all over the world who've got similar ideas to us. And I don't mean idea, just, I mean, there are people who in this country who are, on the political left and have got similar ideas in terms of their criticism of the system. But then what they fall down because what they advocate are reforms of one kind or the other, as Adam said. But there are people who go further than that, who go as far as we do. They may not agree with us in every detail, but you go on social media and there are a variety of groups on Facebook, for example, who are talking about the same thing as us. You know, there's the Moneyless Society group, there's the Capitalism or Socialism group. There's the World of Free Access, and some of them have got large numbers of adherents, far more far more than our web than our Facebook numbers. Some of them have got 20, 30, 40,000. And there are other groups sort of all around the world which go further than the left-wing reformists do and say, we want a moneyless society, et cetera, et cetera. We review some of their publications in the Standard occasionally, and we usually find a few things wrong with what they say from our point of view. But nevertheless, you know, it's good to have them. It's good to know that people have come to these conclusions of their own accord simply by, you know, observing the way the world is organized and coming to conclusions about how it could be organized better.
Yeah, well, that's what we would expect, isn't it? Socialist ideas are thrown up by capitalism, so we'd expect this to happen. I think we're probably returning to the situation at the time that the party was formed. The disagreement wasn't so much about the end to be achieved, but as to how to get there. So, I mean, in between, thanks to the disaster of Russia, you know, the whole thing got derailed. Anyway, Joel, I think you're next. As that person hasn't spoken.
So yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can all hear you.
Yeah. It's just going back to the private property thing. I mean, as more and more people become socialists, those ideas of owning things and wanting to live in a big house or... they'll become less and less. I mean, because we all have different needs, but I mean, it's sort of the fact that people would want that big house or that big car. I mean, I think those ideas would slowly disappear as when we get more and more socialist. I mean, those big houses anyhow would sort of could house quite a number of people or families. So, I mean, that's the sort of good use to be put to. But, as I say, hopefully those high sort of ideas of, like, who's going to do the dirty work, et cetera, I mean, would slowly disappear because, I mean, to get things done, it doesn't mean you're going to be sort of working all day to do it. Thank you.
I mean, that's that's right. But I mean, when we used to speak in Hyde Park, we used to get all these questions. Not just who lives on, who's going to live in Richmond Hill, and who's going to do the dirty work, and so on. These are basic questions which are simple to answer. Right, who's next? Looks like Brian again.
Yes, the question of social housing. I haven't been heavily involved at one period with the housing association locally. The question comes up in regards to eviction within a socialist society, and when it does come about, that it will come about, people will be evicted, or certain people will be evicted from their properties, but mainly because of antisocial behaviour, and that they've been a nuisance to their neighbours and everybody else within the community. And unlike now, where it's the housing officers or the housing management who decides who gets evicted, within the socialist society, because it'll be community ownership of the housing, right? It'll be the community to decide in what process to follow in regards to that eviction, etc. So people, they've gone through a process of of fair warning, similar to the fair warning that we presently get under capitalism in regards to breaching the rules of wage slavery, etc. You know, more than probably it'd be three counts and you're out, right? But having said that, what will be different to what presently takes place in capitalism and the community housing? The community will also find an alternative residence for the person who's committed antisocial behaviour. They won't be chucked out on the road like they are at present, and they've got to find their own way within the market economy of getting further accommodation, you know, taken on by a, which means being taken on by a private landlord. You know, they certainly won't get any help from any other housing association within capitalism. You know, the community will take on the responsibility of finding that alternative accommodation, and hopefully the antisocial behaviour, because of the changing circumstances, the antisocial behaviour will disappear. You know, there was something else that I needed to say, right, in regards to community housing. Right, it would be an excellent means of ensuring, right, with community housing, an excellent means of ensuring that a certain standard is met within the housing sector. And by that standard, I mean the bathroom is up to date, the kitchen is up to date, right, the electricity is up to date, the roof is in good condition, all the rest of it. But most importantly, when a repair requires doing, the community model will be the best model for ensuring that community repairs the place, you know, on a far smaller scale than at present and the housing associations that's about. I mean, the housing association that I'm with, they got 10,000 houses spread over a far greater area, right? Within socialism, the community housing would be localized, right? And it means that they'd be able to obtain their repair and maintenance staff within that community, and then they would be based within that community. And when things need to get repaired in regards to the social housing, right, they begin to get them quick. Unlike now, where you've got to wait weeks, perhaps months, before anything gets done. Because, you know, they'd be small, the housing sector within the community would be small, about 5,000 houses, if that, might be 3,000 houses, right? And ensuring that they're up to a good standard and in a good state of maintenance, etc. You know, well, I think that's about it. There's other things I could talk about in regards to social or community housing, right? But the important thing is that, you know, it'll be the community that's in charge of the allocation of housing, right? It'll be them to decide who takes up what and what housing is suitable for their circumstances. You know, for instance, it's pointless putting a single person in a three-bedroom house and then not leaving any room for a family that comes along and requires that three-bedroom house. Better than wait a while or build a single-person housing so that you can house the single person. And opposite as well, you know, build a three-bedroom housing or four-bedroom housing so that you can house that larger family, etc. At present, it's not done. No, the only time it's taken up a building of housing, both within the social sector and also within the private sector, is when the market demands it. And presently, the market is not demanding a large amount of housing bills. To keep it small, because what it means that is that the housing market itself is very, very profitable. The smaller the housing market, you know, or the larger the house, but the smaller the amount of housing available, the larger the house, the actual housing market is. I think that's about it.
I think, Brian, you're making housing in socialism sound a bit too much like housing in capitalism. I don't think housing associations are a good example. I mentioned council houses, but housing associations, they're the people at the top pay themselves huge salaries, and it's, you know, they're exploiting the people that they're supposed to be housing. But the thing about housing in a socialist society compared with capitalism is that it'll be a place to use, a place to live in. Today, all this stuff about people should own their own house, house becomes an investment. I mean, it's a distortion of what houses are for. You know, people buy a house and then they decorate it and then they sell it again, and it's just a crazy way of organizing housing for people. I mean, you make the point that housing will be allocated locally and decided. Look, who's going to occupy a place for a certain period? And not who's going to own it. I mean, that people won't have ownership rights over the places where they live. I mean, they won't need to. It doesn't make sense. As I say, I think the impression I got from listening to you is you talk about people being evicted. A bit too much like capitalism for my taste. Anyway, Andy, you're on. You need to switch something on if we want to hear you, I think.
Sorry, I was just going to say, if there's anybody else that wants to go before me, that's fine.
Yeah, it would be fine, but there isn't, so you're
on. Okay. Adam, you answered half of what I was going to say to Brian. I wasn't sure if I was quite hearing Brian properly there, because I thought, well, you know, it is pretty much Brian, with respect, you were sort of talking about as though socialism is implemented tomorrow and we just have all the rules in place that exist now, and we have some sort of higher power of socialism and government or whatever, with powers to, evict people, you know, for so-called antisocial behaviour and whatever. But I was just trying to think in a sort of a broader sense, a bigger sort of sense. And I think this question of antisocial behaviour is interesting, because Brian also triggered this with me as well about, you've got the antisocial behaviour always sort of implies in the mass media this sort of feckless families, feckless parents who are addicted to alcohol and gambling and can't hold a job down and can't look after their kids properly, and the kids are feral and they run around all over the place. We're really, in a more enlightened future society, everybody, children and their parents and the generationally, we'll all be socialized differently. We won't be holding on to this idea necessarily. I mean, it's not for me to say, but of the nuclear family, You know, this idea that you've got to have a mum and a dad and three kids all living in some small place together, you know, it might not be like that quite in the same way. And so those kids then gradually will become adults and perhaps sort of you wouldn't need to have this worry about antisocial behaviour because everybody would be taking care of each other gradually, sort of. I know it sounds a bit like a hippie idea at the moment, but I really think that that is how things would be. And it's an absolute nonsense to sort of worry about standards in housing, standards in construction and things like that, because obviously that again should be baked in or oven ready or whatever the capitalist politicians say about these things, because the standards are all there, the materials are all there, the abundance is all there in terms of knowing how to create good facilities for people to live in and good shelter for people. But actually, you know, look, I don't need to go on about this because I think we all know anyway. Adam said it, you know, this idea of this housing market is absolutely crazy. I mean, I'm very, very lucky. I bought a little house 20 odd years ago, and it's probably now, I think, tripled, if not more, in value just by an accident of what I did, you know, just needed to buy somewhere to live, you know, and other people, you know, that are younger than me now can't even afford to get a deposit for a house together in the area that I live in. It's crazy. It doesn't give me any pleasure at all, really, because I won't benefit from it. I just live here. When I die, I'll pass it to my relatives, and that's that. You know, Eileen will, well, if Eileen lives, she might have it for whatever for a few years, you know, but it doesn't really benefit anybody, does it? You know, I'm just enjoying it while I'm here. So, anyway, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I think that's what quite a few people will have in socialism. They'll enjoy the house they're in while they're in it. Anyway, Mark, you want to come back?
Yes, please. Yes, and thank you, Andrew, because that's a point that I was going to make. And Joel made a similar point that I've said this on several occasions before. I'm very against people living in little individual dog kennels, which I think is a terrible thing. It's not a healthy situation for anybody. I'm a great believer in the clan system and the extended family. And so, you know, it's living in a tiny little, well, so-called council house type thing is not my idea of an existence at all. For me personally, I'd like 6 hectares of land so that I could keep a few beehives and grow some organic vegetables and have a bit of livestock on the land, and a house with about 30 rooms so that my whole extended family can live there as well. And that, I think that is the way society is going to go, because that worked for the Scottish clan system. It worked for Maori social housing in New Zealand, that the elderly people look after the very little ones, so that the people in the middle who are of working age and have the physical fitness can tend the crops and look after the place. There'd be no need for having to put children into a creche or to put elderly people into these horrible old people's farms. I think that's the way society would go under socialism, is to have the extended family and have a large parcel of land, not just a little pocket handkerchief bit with a dog kennel on it. So anyway, that's my idea anyway. Thank you.
I don't see why the extended household necessarily has to be the extended family. But anyway, I'm sure you're right. That's better than now. I see you want to come back again, Andy.
Yeah, am I still on? Can you hear me? Yeah?
No, nobody's cut you off. We can all hear you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. The other important thing that doesn't really get discussed very often, I think, is that due to the sort of rise of industrial capitalism, and now even more so the needs of like office culture and all that type of thing, people who can't quite make the grade, in being productive in capitalist terms, get left to one side on that. And I'm sort of bouncing a bit off Moggy's point there about how extended communities, extended family, whatever we might want to call it, help each other out. There's a gentleman that lives just round the corner from me, Michael, and he provides a brilliant community service to all of us lot that get up in the morning and jump in our cars and go off to work. And whenever the bins get collected, you know, on a Tuesday morning for the brown bin and on a Wednesday for the green one and this and that, Michael goes around and he picks the bins up for each person on Walton Road where I live and on Jesse Road where he lives. And he pulls the bins in and he puts them all where they should be, as near to your gate as possible. And then not only that, on the verges where the road is in front of the houses, he keeps all the verges really neat. And we bought a lawnmower for Michael because he does that for everybody. And I'm just trying to say that, you know, people who maybe with a learning disability or some other issue that might preclude them from, being involved in the world of, feeling important or having a job role in capitalism. People like that who have those barriers to their own participation are embraced by their community. And that, again, is something that you can't have when people just live in little boxes, like individuals living in individual flats, not really seeing other people, not really smelling the grass and not really just being able to just interact, on an ordinary everyday basis. That's something that, that is what I suppose we talk about when we look at the theory of alienation. You get alienated, you get depressed. It's something that causes people not to feel very good. So, yeah, thanks anyway.
Yeah, you're right. Capitalism does tend to reduce us to social atoms when we sort of collide to meet each other in the marketplace. But of course, the motto of socialism, from each according to their ability, from each according to their needs. People do what they can and whatever it is, yeah. And everybody has their needs satisfied to their same extent. Right, we got two people again. Freddie first, and then Dougie. We can't hear you, Freddie, so you want to ask the question.
I learn all this new technology yet. How to switch this thing on and off. It's been very interesting discussions and observations and comments from many of the participants tonight, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't wholeheartedly agree with in other parts, to try and be diplomatic about it. And I think there is quite a degree of social cohesion just now in a capitalist society amongst workers. And it manifests itself in many ways. Clearly, there are situations, for example, if you're living in a tower block, then, yeah, it's not necessarily conducive to having this sort of extended family, etc. But, you know, I have a friend that lives in a home where they quite often meet together in a communal area and socialise with each other, etc. But at the end of the night, and I'm one for this, to be honest. At the end of the night, I like to go back to my own pit and relax and chill out and do, you know, what I want to do. So I don't wholeheartedly agree, though, that we're all alienated from each other. And this question of extended families, well, we are. I think that manifests itself in many different ways also. You look at the tens of thousands of people every week that go out and do voluntary work, etc., and get on great with each other. They'll go for a few beers with each other at the end of it. We spoke, and I remember Andrew speaking about this maybe 3-4 weeks ago, about when you have an allotment. And I've got an allotment, and I mentioned it at the time, that on the allotment, people communicate and they get on well. Generally, perhaps not everyone, but in general, we communicate with each other, help each other. If there's a particularly physical part of work needing done, we get a few people mucking in with each other, etc., etc. So perhaps I'm picking up, I have to echo what somebody said earlier on, that at times I'm not picking up clearly what has been said. So I may be misinterpreting or misunderstanding what others have perhaps spoken about earlier on. And in terms of housing, I was in a fortunate position that I bought my own house, not because I necessarily, but because I wanted my own house. I mean, I'll be honest with you here as well. I saw it as an investment for my children, so that when I peg it, that there's perhaps something there that gives my children a bit better standard than that what I had, etc., and what my parents had. So I think overall that this question of trying to get the party create case across that perhaps we're a little bit negative at times and understanding that the vast majority of the world's population can get on pretty well with each other. And we know that this whole question of nationalism, of patriotism, etc., is a bugbear for us. But I think that in terms of trying to propagate the party case, Adam mentioned earlier on there about when you used to have down at Hyde Park at Speaker's Corner. And I remember well when living in Glasgow that we regularly had outdoor public meetings, etc. And there may still be a place for that, albeit I'm trying to get myself accustomed and acclimatized to use of social media, not having been sort of brought up with it. But I'm certainly getting encouraged by other people, to tell you the truth, in terms of seeking to propagate the case further. So Well, as I say, I generally agree with most of what has been said. I think sometimes our thinking, or certainly some thinking, on the sort of coalition of workers is underplayed. I think that the vast majority of us get on pretty well with each other, even although we may still like our own sort of private bit of space at times. Thank you.
Literally. You need to press a button, I think.
Is it me to speak, Adam?
Yes, you, yeah.
Okay. Well, I gave a bit of news stuff recently, and I was looking at things like Alzheimer's and stuff like that. I mean, 50% of people in care homes have got some degenerative disorder, really, you know. And I think sometimes we forget about the human condition. And there's all sorts of mental illnesses and stuff like that. And a lot of people look after people who've got dementia or whatever, you know. They give up jobs and, you know, family members look after their parents. And I think in this country about 40,000 people under 65 have got some form of dementia or whatever. It sounds a bit pessimistic, but I mean, you've got to think of the human condition. It's all very well saying we're all going to be fine in old age. I mean, as I say, the best care possible should be given to these people, and we should invest in drugs to cure it, really. You know, they did come up with a drug recently that kind of slows down the progress by 30-odd% or whatever. There's another drug that slows it by 27%. But I don't know how they know that, really. You know, it might be, you know, scans on the brain and things like that. You know, looking at what causes it, what the brain does to cause it, really, you know. So I'm just saying, you know, there is a human condition to think about. We're not all going to be well for all of our life or whatever, you know. So I think you've just got to have the best possible care. That's what I wanted to say. And about houses, I mean, I bought a house in 2000, and it's probably been a good investment for my family and friends or whatever when I die or whatever. And there is a guy, Gary Stevens, he talks about things for economic reasons. And I think he was asked by somebody, how do you make money being a working class? I said, the only way you can make money is to buy a house or an ear. And, okay, you still need somewhere to live, so you can't sell it and have the life of Riley. But that was one of the things he said in Capitalism, you know, that's the only way you can actually increase your wealth, yeah.
That's probably true, actually. But of course, the human condition will continue in a socialist society, but it can be dealt with much better than it is under capitalism. We're not saying that socialism is going to cure everything and nobody's going to be sick or ill or get dementia. It's just the conditions how it's dealt with, it will be a completely different atmosphere. I mean, we can't blame people for buying a house under capitalism as an investment. It's sort of rational behavior under capitalism, but it's a capitalist society that turns, you know, housing into a market and into an investment. Right. Is there anybody else that wants to?
Adam, you switched off.
After telling everybody else they're switched off, I'm switched off. Okay, yeah. What I'm saying is, there seems to be no more speakers, and we've kept going until 20 past 9. So we can call this meeting to an end. Next week, it's not the advertised speaker. It's not Steve Finch. It's going to be Paul Bennett. They're swapping around. Paul was going to give a talk in June, but he's going to give it now this week, and Steve will get his next. But I'm afraid this is a subject which will make Andy's hair stand on end if he takes his hat off. It's going to be about degrowth. There will be a meeting next Friday, but there won't be the following Friday, the second of June. Okay then. So Maggie wants to say something.
Yes. Well, I just want to ask about a couple of comrades. We've not heard from Steve Finch or Paul Edwards for a little while. I just wanted to know whether they were well. Maybe they're just busy doing other things.
Well, the reason Steve Finch isn't doing next week is his nephew's getting married, but he'll be back. And I think Paul said he's doing something else on a Friday evening, or he's got health problems. Anyway, he was there last week. He's still around. I'm sure he's on Facebook or something. So I mean, the person we should be worrying about is Alan Johnson. We don't know what happened to him. I mean, I think something really bad could have happened to him, because we haven't heard from him now for 2 months, and we've got no means of communicating with him. He's in the jungle somewhere near the border of Cambodia and Laos. So he's the person that we should be worried about. But we've been doing all we can to try and find out what's happened to him. But we just have to wait till somebody tells us.